It is Friday, March the 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, more U.S. sanctions on Moscow, plus Russia holding a presidential election Sunday.
Not only will Mr. Putin be endorsed for another 6 years, but that he's likely to stay on until the end of his days.
Remembering the My Lai massacre.
Unfortunately, for the 504 people that were killed in the My Lai massacre on March 16, 1968, they were all buried in mass graves and several families were all killed. That's why we dedicate this shrine to the victims, to honor them.
Also ahead, the U.S. school walkouts and a snafu at Snapchat. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The White House is saying the Trump administration will maintain tough policies against Russia. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked by reporters if Russia is a friend or foe of the U.S.
I think that's something that Russia is going to have to make that determination. They're going to have to decide whether or not they want to be a good actor or a bad actor. I think you can see from the actions that we've taken up until this point, we're going to be tough on Russia until they decide to change their behavior.
Earlier on Thursday, Washington placed more sanctions on Russian individuals as entities are alleged U.S. election meddling and cyber attacks, but put off targeting oligarchs and government officials close to Russian President Vladimir Putin, prompting U.S. lawmakers and both major parties to say President Trump needs to do much more. Also during a news briefing, Sanders declined to comment on a New York Times report that the U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has subpoenaed the Trump Organization for documents, including some related to Russia, and referred questions to the Trump Organization.
We're going to continue to fully cooperate out of respect for the Special Counsel. We're not going to comment for any specific questions about the Trump Organization. I'd refer you there.
A Trump Organization spokesperson did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Russians voting on Sunday for president in an election which virtually boils down to one choice, Vladimir Putin, who has essentially been in power since the late 1990s. He faces only one token opposition with two chief rivals, Boris Nemtsov, who is actually dead, and Alexei Navalny, who inspired mass protests last year and is in jail. Kyle Wilson is a former Australian diplomat to Russia and is now a visiting fellow at the Australian National University. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty he believes Mr. Putin remains quite popular at home, with a recent survey showing nearly half of those polled considering him the country's second greatest leader, only behind Joseph Stalin. Wilson says Mr. Putin is likely to remain in power as long as he lives.
I mean, even Russian commentators are saying that not only will Mr. Putin be endorsed for another 6 years in what is being called an election, but really is, you know, a formalized voting procedure, a kind of ritual, but that he's likely to stay on until the end of his days, because to leave power in Russia, as Russian history shows, is very, very risky. In the whole history of Russia, only four Russian leaders have left power peacefully and alive. You've asked about the turnout. Well, we know, I think, from reliable reports that a lot of pressure will be put on people to turn out and vote, to actually turn up to the ballot box, so-called. I would have thought that what's probably very important for Mr. Putin is how many people turn out in Crimea. He will assume that Moscow won't vote for him because Moscow is one part of the country where, you know, he's failed to gain a majority before. And that, in a way, is a comment that says that, you know, Russian elections are not completely stage-managed. But I would have thought for Mr. Putin, absolutely crucial will be, does he get a big turnout in Crimea? Does he get a very positive endorsement in Crimea? And then, of course, he can say to the nation, look what the people of Crimea have said about me.
Where is the opposition?
The opposition is in a very difficult situation because, as you know, they are harassed. I think it's not going too far to say that they are persecuted. The genuine opposition is denied access to the state media. We know that a vast majority of Russians get their news from state television. We know that about 70% of Russians believe what they see and hear on state television. We know that state television is essentially 90% in the hands of the Kremlin. Therefore, the opposition has been using, to the best of its ability and ingenuity, social media, and it's been using it pretty effectively. But I think the other thing you'd probably say is that the opposition is in some disarray because it really has only one figure around whom it can coalesce. That figure is Navalny. The other potential figure, who was Mr. Nemtsov, was of course murdered only 300 metres from the Kremlin about 4 years ago. So the opposition is in an invidious position, which makes it all the more surprising that the Kremlin, Mr. Putin and his advisers, really seem to be quite perturbed by, you know, the challenge that the opposition is mounting. If you have a man as popular as Mr. Putin, who's been voted the second greatest man in history, who claims a popularity rating of something like 80%, why should such a man be so concerned to prevent Mr. Navalny from running against him as a genuine candidate? Well, the only logical answer can be that Mr. Putin and those around him really do see Mr. Navalny as a credible threat.
That's Kyle Wilson, a former Australian diplomat to Russia, now a visiting fellow at the Australian National University. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. The leaders of Britain, France, Germany, as well as the United States have jointly condemned the poisoning of a former Russian spy on British soil. It's been blamed on Moscow, calling it the first offensive use of a nerve agent in Europe since the Second World War. Former spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia were found unconscious on a park bench in the English town of Salisbury and rushed to the hospital, where they remain in serious condition. Several other individuals, including a police officer, were sickened. They all were supposedly exposed to a nerve agent. British Prime Minister Theresa May visited Salisbury.
There is a police investigation involving hundreds of officers being undergone into this particular act that took place here on the streets of Salisbury. I've been down here today thanking all the emergency services for the work that they have been doing here, meeting people from the local community, hearing about the impact on the local community and seeing what a great city it is to come and visit. Of course, the police investigation will be aiming to bring to justice those who perpetrated this act, but we are very clear that Russia is culpable in relation to the use of this particular military-grade nerve agent. Now, of course, we will be looking at issues about how this came to be here in this country, but that is a matter for the police investigation. We must let the police do their job.
Russia has denied any involvement in all of this. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Today, March 16th, marks the 50th anniversary of what is known as the My Lai Massacre, when U.S. soldiers on a mission to find and destroy a Viet Cong unit instead attacked a village and killed 504 civilians, mostly women, children, and even old men. VOA's Asia's David Byrd has the story.
Pham Thanh Kong was thrown into a family bomb shelter along with his mother and siblings. American soldiers threw grenades into the shelter, killing everyone in Pham's family and leaving him unconscious with head and torso injuries.
When my father picked me up, I was covered in blood, with pieces of flesh and hair of my mother. My siblings were all over my body. My clothes were ripped. I had a lot of injuries on my head and body.
The incident became the most notorious episode in modern U.S. military history, but it was not the only such massacre. U.S. military records described 300 other such cases of incidents similar to My Lai during the Vietnam War. A special memorial has been dedicated to the victims of the massacre. Relatives and well-wishers place incense on the altars of the shrine. Win Min Tri is the director of the cultural department of Quang Nai province.
According to Vietnamese tradition, those who pass away should be honored on a family altar. When it comes to the anniversary of their death each year, family members would place incense and offer a meal on their altar. Unfortunately for the 504 people that were killed in the My Lai massacre on March 16, 1968, they were all buried in mass graves and several families were all killed. That's why we dedicate this shrine to the victims, to honor them.
American Vietnam vet Mike Hasty visited the memorial site.
This is what my country did to the Vietnamese people. And I carry a lot of guilt and a lot of pain because of that. I carry a lot of shame for what my government did.
The U.S. Army would later charge 14 men, including Charlie Company leader Lieutenant William Calley, Captain Ernest Medina, and Colonel Orrin Henderson with crimes related to the events at My Lai. All were acquitted except for Lieutenant Calley, who was found guilty of premeditated murder for ordering the shootings. He argued that he was only following orders from his commanding officer. Calley was given a life sentence, but his sentence was reduced upon appeal to 20 years and later to 10. He was paroled in 1974. Vietnam and the United States normalized diplomatic relations in 1995, and the U.S. is one of Vietnam's top trading partners. Historian Yung Chung Wook says that the greatest outcome of the massacre is that both nations have learned their lessons.
As we organize the 50th anniversary for the crimes committed by the U.S. Army in Son My, not very far from there, a U.S. aircraft carrier docks in Da Nang for a friendly visit. The war has ended and both nations have learned its lessons. The greatest outcome of the lessons is for two nations to come close together in friendliness and share responsibilities.
For My Lai survivor Pham Thanh Cong, there is sadness, but not bitterness.
I'm ready to forgive them and move on from the past. And I want them to do good deeds to make up for what they did. I don't want to think heavily about it or hold on to hatred. Let bygones be bygones.
To see a special photo collection on the My Lai Memorial, visit our Facebook page, VOA Asia.
And that was VOA Asia's David Bird reporting.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
And turning now to U.S. politics, in a race with national implications, Democrat Conor Lamb declared victory in a very close special congressional election held this week in the state of Pennsylvania. Lamb holds a lead of several hundred votes over Republican candidate Rick Saccone, a strong supporter of President Trump. The apparent Democratic victory is what has been a reliable Republican district could be a sign of things to come as both parties prepare for this year's midterm congressional elections later in the year. VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone has our report.
Democrats celebrate the apparent victory of Conor Lamb in Pennsylvania.
It took a little longer than we thought, but we did it.
Campaigning as a moderate Democrat, Lamb ran surprisingly strong in a district that President Trump carried by nearly 20 points.
We fought to find common ground, and we found it almost everywhere. Democrats, Republicans, independents, each of us Americans.
Republican Rick Saccone was not ready to concede the race.
We're going to fight all the way to the end. You know I never give up.
Saccone cast himself as the president's wingman, and Trump campaigned on his behalf just days earlier.
The whole world, remember that, they're all watching. We want to keep it going. We want to keep the agenda, the Make America Great going. You got to get them in. This is a very important race.
The Pennsylvania result follows on the heels of Democratic victories last year in Virginia and Alabama, perhaps setting the stage for a difficult midterm election for the president, according to Larry Sabato.
The opposition to Donald Trump is as intense as I have seen since the last year of Nixon's presidency. It is so intense, it's so hot, that it could result in a much bigger turnover than we think in the midterm elections to the Democrats away from the Republicans.
Some Republicans see the race as a wake-up call looking ahead to November, including Kevin Cramer of North Dakota.
I think for Republicans, the message has to be run on what we've done and what we're doing, because we have a good record.
Midterm elections historically are unkind to sitting presidents, notes analyst Michael Barone.
The party of the president is generally going to be held responsible for what the president and the administration have done, particularly when, as now, Republicans have a majority in both houses. So there's a vulnerability there.
And a Democratic victory in Trump country is a major warning sign for Republicans, says Sabato.
The fact that a Democrat managed to win in that district suggests that Republicans in easily 100 districts around the country who are incumbents now have to worry, because they're representing places that went for Trump by much less.
Democrats need a gain of 24 House seats and 2 Senate seats to reclaim congressional majorities in November. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Thousands of students rallied across the United States this week demanding an end to gun violence. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports the school walkouts and memorials came 1 month after the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, that left 17 people dead.
Students gathered on the streets of New York City.
Every day, students are dying and no one's doing anything about it, and we don't like it. And enough is enough.
We will not be silent!
And Atlanta.
I'm fighting for gun control and to stop gun violence.
In Oakland, they remembered the victims in Florida.
Look, I don't want to be a victim.
Through speeches and music, and also the victims of gun violence closer to home.
Like, I had a cousin that got shot. He was just walking down the block. And I got my friend Davon, he got shot. They just talked about him. Yeah, I got a couple friends that got shot, family members that have been paralyzed.
A somber school assembly in Ottawa, Illinois, honored the 17 killed in Florida. Students say it was not a political event or against gun ownership.
It really wasn't. We're just trying to help people feel safe while being here at school.
How to end the violence? Some students want a ban on high-powered assault weapons like the one used in Florida. Others want to raise the age for buying guns, hire more armed school police, or even armed teachers. The debates are emotional, but these students say that something must be done.
If we don't make a change, it will never stop. It will be the same thing. Hear about a shooting, cry about it, move on.
The gun issue has made this student an activist in her home state of California.
We want state legislators to know that we want our voices to be heard. I think given Parkland's shooting victims, and they've risen up and they've had a whole legislation movement in Florida, it's kind of inspired me personally to use my voice.
For some, the message highlights student safety. For others, that students can make a difference.
The youth are learning that we have a voice. And as we're getting older, we're learning that we can use that voice to make a difference and to make change.
Renewed activism from a new generation of students. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
South by Southwest is not just an annual music festival and tech conference in the U.S. city of Austin, Texas. It also includes venues where people from specific countries or regions of the world come together to share ideas. This is the inaugural year for Africa House at South by Southwest, and it's providing some valuable networking opportunities for Africans who come to experience and benefit from the festival. We get more now from VOA's Elizabeth Lee in Austin.
From African musicians to African entrepreneurs.
It's a premium handcrafted leather casual sneaker.
You'll find many gathered here at Africa House.
We've traveled all the way from Africa to meet Africa here and to meet people that we otherwise would never have had a chance to meet back home.
Brenda Katusije traveled from Uganda to talk about her startup Wazi Vision at Africa House. She says her frames made from recycled plastic are 80% cheaper than what's on the market.
We need people that are here that can sell them in their stores. We need people with online e-commerce platforms that can help with logistics and everything. I've made some really meaningful contacts that I plan on following up on.
And that is the purpose of Africa House, creating a platform to bring Africans to South by Southwest who would otherwise not be here. C.D. Glenn is with the U.S. African Development Foundation, one of the sponsors of Africa House.
They're coming here, to some extent, to network with the diaspora. These are Africans who are now living here in Austin and doing things at the local level, but also who are looking for a real connection back to Africa.
It's a network is to make more vibes.
Musicians and entrepreneurs at Africa House
helping people. Benevolent.
Are also meeting members of the African diaspora from other U.S. cities, American investors, and other fellow Africans such as Bumi Akiamichu from Nigeria.
We look for new technologies, we look for new startups. So while we look for startups, that allows us to actually make investments in those startups that can collaborate with a parent company.
This was a place where they can make connections that they would otherwise not be able to make. So it was a long trip, but well worth it.
Glenn says this may be the first Africa House at South by Southwest, but it won't be the last. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Austin.
And still ahead, a snafu at Snapchat. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A Renaissance man is defined as a person who has wide interests and is an expert in several areas. The late great Stephen Hawking, who died March 14th at age 76, was a true example of a Renaissance man. Professor Hawking helped us better understand the workings of our universe. Not only was he a renowned theoretical physicist, cosmologist, and author, Hawking was also a pop culture superstar. Over the years, he appeared in a number of movies and television shows, authored many best-selling books, and was even a guest performer on recordings by artists such as Pink Floyd and Monty Python. He gave wonderful advice when he told us to look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see and wonder about what makes the universe exist. Be curious. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. You know, marketing music can sometimes be a bit tricky. Campaigns can gather much attention for artists, and sometimes that attention comes with the wrong reasons. Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald shares with VOA's Jim Stevenson an epic failure this week by the social media platform Snapchat involving Rihanna and her former boyfriend Chris Brown.
Snapchat took a swing and missed by a country mile, as they say. Internet marketing can be edgy, but this sort of took things a little bit too far. The platform Snapchat is in hot water after they posted a tasteless advertisement. It was for a mobile game called Would You Rather, and it asked if readers would rather slap Rihanna or punch Chris Brown. Now, you might remember, back in 2009, Chris Brown received 5 years of probation and 6 months of community service after he pleaded guilty to assaulting his then-girlfriend, Rihanna. Well, early on Thursday, Rihanna responded to the ad. She said that while she had no personal feelings about it, she thought that it insulted all people who had been victims of domestic violence. And she recommended that Snapchat delete both the advertisement and the game. Well, someone at Snapchat came to their senses, and they responded with a statement calling the ad disgusting. The statement went on to say it never should have appeared on their service. They apologized for having it clear their review process, which kind of makes me wonder if they have a review process.
Right.
And they're investigating how it happened, so it will not happen again. And needless to say, the game has also been blocked from running on Snapchat. I think Rihanna's tried to put this behind her, mm-hmm. and this was a kind of an unpleasant reminder of what went down in 2009. And we can only hope that the people at Snapchat are maybe a little more fastidious about what they put out there in the future. They got dragged online, as you can imagine.
There's often a fine line between being edgy and just being wrong in this
yes.
case. And, you know, artists, social media, everybody wants to be hip. Everybody wants to have something that's flashy out there and attracts people. And I'm sure that was the intent, but the review process certainly was lacking.
People are trying to figure out how to market to the younger generation. And sometimes they just really missed the mark, and I think this is a prime example.
Perhaps, like we've seen in other situations, they can turn this around and make a positive out of it. You never know.
Yeah, yeah, they very well could, and they should.
We would like to remind you to check out the Top 20 Countdown. Each and every week, it's on VOA 1, of course, hosted by Ray McDonald, who you will also find on Twitter.
At Ray on the Hits. Read more about this story. I posted it on my Twitter feed.
Oh, we'll be looking for it. Thank you so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
I'm getting paper. Look at me now. Oh, look at me now. Yeah. I'm fresher than a moth.
Okay. And we're here to tell you that the first round of the Arnold Palmer Invitation Golf Tournament has happened. Tiger Woods shot a 74, partnered with Jordan Spieth. He also shot a 74, first-round leader Henrik Stenson. Well, he was an 8-under par 64, so he's big for today's round. Big Tiger Mania Day out there at the golf course. Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always great to have you come around. The latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
30 years ago, on March 16, 1988, and just before the start of the Al-Anfal operation, the regime of then-president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, committed one of the worst atrocities of the modern era: the murder by poison gas of thousands of civilians in the Kurdish-Iraqi town of Halabja. As part of a genocidal campaign against the Kurds and other ethnic groups in northern Iraq, government forces spent 2 days shelling the city of Halabja with rockets and napalm, an incendiary gel that sticks to skin and causes terrible burns. On the second day, March 16th, they suddenly changed tactics. Attacking aircraft began to pepper the civilian parts of the city with canisters of chemical weapons, including mustard gas and the nerve agent sarin, Tabin, and VX. That day, some 3,500 to 5,000 people died within minutes. Another 7,000 to 10,000 were injured, crippled, or suffered long-term health problems. Although there is some evidence that Saddam Hussein's forces had used chemical agents before March 16, 1988, the attack on Halabja is thought to be the first documented assault by Saddam Hussein's forces using chemical weapons. But it would not be the last. Early in 1987, Saddam Hussein authorized the use of chemical weapons in attacks on as many as 24 Kurdish villages. For his role in these heinous attacks, the dictator's cousin and the campaign's commander, Ali Hassan al-Majid, earned the nickname Chemical Ali. The Al-Anfal campaign was a series of horrific crimes perpetrated by Iraqi leaders against their own civilian population. The gassing of the citizens of Halabja was one of the worst atrocities perpetrated by Saddam Hussein against his own people. For his part in it and for other crimes, Chemical Ali was executed by hanging. The Iraqi Special Tribunal dropped charges against Saddam Hussein himself, only because he was executed after being convicted in a separate case. The head of government has a responsibility to the country and to its people to act in their best interest. Ultimately, few dictators die in bed or exit the scene of their crimes gracefully. The fate of those who instigated the Al-Anfal and killed thousands of innocents in Halabja should serve as a warning to others who follow in their murderous footsteps.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.